The second class in the five-week course, and many of you realized that I was sick last week, so we skipped a week. Or we didn't skip a week, we just put it off for a week. So for those of you who might be new, the five-week introductory course goes systematically through the instructions, the basic instructions for mindfulness meditation, and it does it systematically. Where the first week we talk about the breath meditation, which is the heart or the anchor for the practice. And then today, the second week, we'll talk about mindfulness of the body, how mindfulness is an embodied practice, or how our physical body is included as part of the meditation. And then next week we'll talk about emotions. The following week we'll talk about our thoughts, our cognitive world. And then the last week we'll talk about the integration of the practice into daily life. So you're not supposed to think until about 2 weeks from now. So it'll proceed a lot easier if you can just hold that off until you get the instruction. Now, it's a little bit interesting, or very interesting, the relationship of thought to our experience and to meditation practice. There's a famous analogy in East Asian Buddhism of the painted rice cake. And the idea being that if you paint even the most beautiful, realistic painting of a rice cake, which is delicious looking and looks like it's full of sugar and cream and all kinds of wonderful things, no matter how long you look at that rice cake, the picture of it, it's not going to satisfy your hunger. Maybe in our world we would say that if you're endlessly discussing and reading the menu, you're never really going to be satisfied. Or perhaps another way of saying this, kind of what I'm trying to get to, is say you go out to a restaurant and you buy a meal. Maybe it's a big deal that you could afford this particular kind of meal. You don't go out very often or whatever. And you're there with a friend. And you notice by the time the meal's finished that you've had a very lively conversation, but you never tasted the food because you were so absorbed in the conversation, continuing the train of thought that's verbalized externally as conversation. Our capacity to live caught up or preoccupied in our thoughts, in our ideas, in our words, sometimes, maybe more than sometimes, often, keeps us from experiencing things more directly. And the aim of mindfulness practice is to help us to experience life more directly. And there's a sense that if we do that, if we can experience life directly, then we can also learn how to let the life or our inner life proceed or unfold or process itself as it wishes, as it needs to. If we're lost in our thoughts and our fears and our preoccupations, keeping ourselves removed from direct contact of our inner life, that our inner life doesn't proceed or unfold or unravel, develop as smoothly as it would if we were really directly connected to it. And so somehow find... Now, it's very important to understand that in mindfulness meditation, it isn't that we're trying to stop thinking. There's no notion in Buddhism that I understand that our thoughts are enemies to the spiritual life. But rather, the attempt is to try to find a more balanced relationship to life. And one of the ways we become imbalanced for many of us is to live too much in the cognitive world, too much in the mental world of thoughts, ideas, thinking about the past or thinking about the future. And to live more balanced mode is to live in a much richer world than the kind of two-dimensional world that exists when we only think, in our thoughts. I think of the world of thoughts as being the original virtual reality. And that's where most of us are living, you know, in a virtual reality. Now, perhaps one way of kind of making similar point is the football analogy, which I like to talk about. Because some years ago, I was watching football with some other Vipassana teachers, and it wasn't a particularly common occurrence for me to watch football. And my friend, he had the remote. And as a sensible person does, I think, when the commercial started, he hit the mute, and we started to have a conversation, because it's more interesting, I thought, than watching the commercial. And so that was very nice. Then the commercial ended, and the football game started again. And what was odd was my friend who had the control of the remote didn't hit the mute button the second time to get the sound to start again. And since I thought, well, this is a mindfulness teacher after all, and he's supposed to be mindful of what's going on, and you know, the three of us became silent again and started watching the screen. So this is an unusual situation. Why don't I kind of, rather than kind of nudge him, why don't I just see what's going on here? So so for a while I watched the football game without any sound. And sure enough, I could follow the game close enough without the sound. I mean, these guys stood up in line facing each other, and they ran into each other and fell down. And you know, it was pretty clear. Then they did it again. And every once in a while, one of the people would kind of get away from the others, and he'd be holding the ball, and you could see him. He'd be making progress down the field. He'd go to the, you know, the 40-yard line, the 30-yard line. You kind of figure, well, if no one catches him up to him soon, he'll probably get a home run or whatever it is they call it, you know. You know, and so you can kind of make it, and then, oh, here comes someone. Oh, no, he looks like he's going to tackle him. Yeah, he tackled him, and, oh, well, he only made it to a 20. And you can kind of get a sense of that from just watching without sound. Now, after a while, my friend did hit the mute button. And what struck me was a huge difference between watching the game without the sound and with the sound. And with the sound, the main difference was there was a commentator, a sportscaster, who was making kind of, you know, blow-by-blow account of what was going on in a rather enthusiastic voice. So that when the person kind of broke free from that double line of guys and was running down the field, you know, in the 40 and the 30, it wasn't just simply, oh yeah, here he goes, he's crossing those lines and he's going in the right direction. I was kind of like, oh my God, you know, he's made it to the 40, he's made it to the 30, and I'm ready to kind of pounce out of my chair and go, yeah, you know, go for it. And all this adrenaline and juice goes inside of me and I'm like, all excited, right? And the experience of watching with a commentator was very different from without. However, the tendency for most of us, the tendency for me, was in watching the game, normally watching a football game or watching a soap opera or whatever, and you have the canned laughter or you have the commentary or whatever going on, is we don't differentiate the experience of the football game from the commentary, from the sportscaster's enthusiasm and words and everything that's going along. Now, I had a friend who made this distinction. He was very aware of this, and he would leave his sound of his television off when he watches football, but he turns on the radio, because the local radio sportscasters are much more enthusiastic fans of the 49ers than the national commentator is. So he preferred to have even more enthusiasm. But the point being, most of us don't differentiate the experience of the football game per se, what it is, versus our experience of it happening through the filter of the commentator. Are you following me? So this is exactly how it is for most of us in normal life. We're constantly making comments about our life, about ourselves, very commonly about ourselves, right? Or ourselves in relationship to the world, or the world in relationship to us, or, you know, whatever. We're making comments about stuff. And our commentary isn't the same thing as a direct experience. For one thing, the commentary might or might not be accurate. But say, even though it's accurate, I mean, most menus are accurate about what the restaurant has. But you don't want to confuse the menu for the experience. If we're caught up and lost in our commentaries about fear, or commentaries about desire, or commentaries about whatever it might be, worry, we're going to have very little direct experience of ourselves as we actually are, or direct experience of our friend as she actually is, or a direct experience of any situation at all. It's possible to watch a beautiful sunset and not just simply kind of take in the wonderful feeling that comes with watching a sunset, but to be in your thoughts, oh, that sunset isn't quite as good as yesterday's sunset, and if I would improve on it with a little bit more, you know, pink over there and orange down there on the right. And it's possible to kind of be in that kind of thought rather than really experiencing it. Or having, or maybe receiving a massage. It's possible, again, to be completely lost in the world of thoughts and commentary about the massage or about something completely different, and not really be present for the actual feelings of the muscles being soothed and relaxed and stroked. So this is a very important distinction, if you can make this and understand it, To help in meditation practice. To see that there's a world of difference between being present for oneself directly, to experience the breath directly, to experience our embodied experiences directly, to experience whatever's happening in the present moment directly through all our senses, the senses of our of touch, of sight, of smell, of taste, as opposed to thinking about things and living in that commentary and thoughts and ideas about what it is. And what we're trying to do in meditation is to try to rest more in the direct experience so we're not constantly being pulled into that world of comments, of commentary. To live in the world of experience rather than to live in the world of commentary. Not necessarily to shut up commentary, but to put it in its rightful place. It's just one little piece of the puzzle of who we are. It's not the central player. And one of the marvelous things about, I think, most forms of spirituality is that a person who practices spiritual practice slowly begins to find that kind of place the world of thoughts and ideas in their proper place. They no longer have center stage. And there's still something we delight in, perhaps, or enjoy, or whatever, but they're just a piece of a much bigger, vaster ocean or puzzle of who we are. And it's much more relaxing. It's much more pleasant to live in life if our thoughts and our ideas aren't center stage. So with that lengthy introduction, we can maybe start with a little sitting. Bruce, I could use some water. Another very important principle of mindfulness meditation is that we're absolutely not at war against any part of ourselves. There's no part of ourselves which is wrong. You might think that now that Gil has said the commentary is kind of not where it's at, that if I have a lot of commentary, I've done it wrong. What mindfulness practice is about is simply recognizing what's happening. And if what's happening is a lot of commentary, it's very valuable to recognize that. So take a comfortable, alert posture, a posture where the spine expresses a sense of alertness, aliveness. And then around that alert spine, it's nice in the beginning to take a few deep breaths, and then as you breathe out, to relax your body. Breathing in deeply, breathing out fully, letting yourself relax. And then let your breath be normal. Let it breathe itself in whatever way it wants. And then also in the beginning of a meditation session, it's nice to scan through your body to see if there's any of the larger muscle groups that can be relaxed. You might start at the top of your head, maybe in your forehead, eyebrows. Sometimes they can be softened a little bit. Sometimes the eyes can get softer and letting the eyeballs rest in the back of their sockets. Sometimes the jaws can be relaxed, softened. Sometimes it's possible to soften and relax the shoulders. And it's also nice to soften the belly, to let the abdomen be relaxed, hanging forward. And then once you've gone through and kind of in a very simple way relaxed your body, take another few moments to simply feel yourself, feel your body as it is right now. Seeing if you can just let it be as it is without any idea that it needs to be different. Just to check in and feel how you are. Taking a few moments to let the body reveal itself to you as it is right now. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences inhalation and exhalation. See if you can make space in your presence, make space in your awareness for the experience of breathing to stay in the forefront of awareness. See if you can be open to experience each inhalation and each exhalation as they follow each other. As you breathe in, the body expands. As you breathe out, the body contracts. There's a rhythm of sensations, a rhythm of movement. Can you very simply feel that directly? Noticing any tendency you have to get lost in commentary or in thoughts. And whenever you notice yourself drifting off in thought, then gently begin again, being with your breathing. in meditation like this, it's completely okay to be just the way you are. Let your body be whatever way it is. But in the midst of that, in the middle of that, to breathe consciously, to breathe with awareness. To feel the experience in the body of inhaling and exhaling. Notice when you're living in the commentary, in your thoughts and ideas. And see if you can switch and instead to live in your direct experience of being in a body, of being in a body that's breathing. Letting the experience of breathing be your guide, be your friend, helping you to enter more and more fully the present moment. Helping you relax. And now, as we get to the end of the meditation, I'd like to suggest that you switch your attention now from the breath and bring your attention to whatever sensation there is in the body that is the strongest sensation at this time. It doesn't have to be particularly strong, but whatever is the strongest physical sensation that you're aware of. And bring your attention to that sensation with a spirit of allowing it to be there. That you're not there to push it away or hold on to it. You're simply going to let it float in the great space of awareness as you feel it, get to know it better. As if you've never really sensed and felt that sensation before in your whole life. Bring some little bit of curiosity to help you bring your awareness closely to that experience in your body. And then as you do that, notice if that experience of your body changes in any way. Does it get stronger or weaker? Notice any tendency you have to get involved in the commentary about the sensation. Let the commentary go. Let it be in the background. Just stay with the direct experience. Strongest sensation. And if it goes away, the sensation, just find another one that's strong. And let that be there and feel it. Noticing how it changes. And then let go of all that. And then for the last minute of the sitting, come back again to your breathing. Letting yourself feel the breath as intimately as possible for 1 minute. Just breathing. Silently, quietly, lovingly. So what we're doing in mindfulness practice is strengthening our ability to be aware. It's the simplest description perhaps that exists. Strengthening our ability to be aware. Our ability to be aware is an overlooked, for most people, is phenomenally overlooked. It's one of the great precious qualities or aspects of being a human being, being sentient. And awareness has some very special qualities, I think. One of them is that awareness itself never judges. Awareness itself never criticizes. awareness itself doesn't never resists. Awareness itself never appropriates things, you know, for our own purposes. Awareness itself doesn't say, this is mine, or this is not me, or this is right, this is wrong. Forgiveness itself, because it doesn't do these things, I like to think of it as being infinitely compassionate and forgiving. It just allows us to kind of be who we are and just holds that in awareness, just you're aware of that. Now, most of us get that form of awareness entangled with all kinds of commentary, of judgments, of criticism, of right and wrong, and all these things. And so our life then suffers because of it. But each of us have the ability, in theory at least, maybe there's no mute button to the soul, unfortunately, but it's possible to see the distinction, the very clear distinction between our experience, our direct experience of any moment, the awareness that is aware of whatever's happening, versus our stories and commentaries, our judgments about that. And the beautiful thing about this is that as we begin discovering this ability to be aware without judgment, we realize that we don't have to always be in judgment or always be in criticism or always be impatient or always be caught up in our desires and our worries and fears. There's another alternative. And realizing there's another alternative to being caught up and preoccupied is one of the doorways into a greater form of freedom in this world that we live in. So what we're trying to do in mindfulness is very much to strengthen this capacity of awareness, so the awareness itself becomes more of a home where we feel comfortable. So that we don't automatically react when things don't go our way or when things do go our way. So that we have a capacity, awareness kind of is much larger in sense than any of our reactions. And so because it's larger than any of our reactions, our reactions don't have to go automatically be acted on. They can be kind of held in this great space of awareness or silence in a sense. So we're kind of developing our capacity to be aware. Another important element of this is we're also then, by developing our awareness, getting to understand better what we're aware of. Many of us don't really see ourselves that clearly or life that clearly. We haven't really studied what's really like to be in a human body, what it's really like to have in emotions, what thoughts really are. So we can use the power of this awareness to look more deeply into something deeper, the nature of what it is we're experiencing. So we don't have to take it naively or take it for granted, which is the case for many of us. There is a beautiful description that people will come to me periodically with of having ridden out one of their desires. And these people usually come with big eyes, and they've never ridden out a desire before. They thought that you're supposed to act on your desires. You know, if you want something, you're supposed to get it, or if you don't get it, you're supposed to get frustrated and angry. And those are the options. And it's very liberating for certain people, especially people who have certain addictions, to actually not do anything with the desire except to feel it, and to investigate it and be present for it. And in the process of getting to know it better and watching it, to kind of it's kind of like a cresting wave. It kind of builds and builds and builds and gets stronger and very demanding. It has to be right now or the whole universe will unravel. And then this magic moment comes where it crests and then it kind of, the strength of it dissipates. And pretty soon you realize that it's gone away. Wow! At the moment when it was cresting and getting stronger, it seemed like the most important desire the world's ever had. And once it's passed, 3 seconds later or a minute later, why did I think it'd be so important? But to use the awareness to stay present and watch what's going on, and we can learn very important aspects of our experience. For example, we learn the nature of our desire. Learn the desire doesn't automatically mean we have to act on them. Very powerful insight. Now, one of the things we study that we learn more about by using this awareness is the body, our physical body, our embodied body. Many of us in our culture don't live much of our times in our body. We often have work that's often very intellectual in nature, a lot of thinking has to go on. It's in front of the computer, perhaps, or we're talking to people constantly, or there aren't that many of us who do physical work. There are such people, but so I find many people aren't so much in their bodies, and it's unfortunate because our bodies is a big part of who we are. The Buddhist tradition doesn't like to create a duality between the mind and the body. In Western culture, some areas, there's a very sharp divide between the mind and the body. And so people sometimes create all kinds of funny relationships between the two of them, antagonistic relationships sometimes. In Buddhism, the human being is a psychophysical whole. The mind body is our unit, they work together. You can distinguish them in a sense, but they really work together. You can't really pull them apart. And who we are, to really be a full human being, is to be a person who has this balanced interworking, interrelationship between our physicality and our mentality. And these two have to work together and be together. And in the fact, in the way that some people are more imbalanced in one side more than the other, they cut off access to a tremendous reservoir of information and wisdom and abilities to respond, either through the mind or through the body. Buddhist spiritual practice, there's many, many kinds of practices in Buddhism, but a great majority of them involve some involvement of the body. Probably the most common form of meditation practice the Buddha taught was mindfulness of the body. And if you add on top of that a mindfulness of the breath, as if the breath is part of the body, a great majority of what the Buddha taught as a meditation practice involved being in the body, feeling the body from the inside, feeling what was going on in your body as you're present. When I did my first one of my first retreats in Thailand, the abbot said at the end of the opening talk, in a kind of offhand way, he said, "Don't do anything that takes you out of your body." And I thought that was a kind of strange thing to say, and I didn't understand it at the time. So I spent a good part of this 10-day retreat reflecting on what did that guy mean by "don't do anything that takes you out of your body." And so the way that that study unfolded was I paid attention to how much I was in my body. And I found that I wasn't so often in my body, and there were often times when I was propelled out of my body, not in some kind of great meditative astral travel, but in the most mundane ways. When the lunch bell rang and I was walking to lunch to the cafeteria, I was literally, my center of gravity, my center of was, you know, a foot in front of me. I was so caught up or preoccupied by the food that was down there in the dining hall, that I wasn't even in my body. Probably my body was leaning forward even slightly, trying to get down there. And I found that the kind of preoccupations that I had in my mind often pulled me out of any sense of being embodied, any sense of being grounded or centered or balanced in my body. When I was afraid, I would notice that I pulled back and my center of gravity was pulled back slightly. Or often for me it was kind of reaching forward for something, for a desire, for a fantasy, for food or whatever. And I discovered myself at that retreat how often I was not centered on myself, centered on my own body. And it became a very powerful practice for me simply to notice that and come back again to a more balanced way of being in my body as opposed to being out of it or being projecting forward. As I've continued my meditation practice from that first retreat, I've learned even more more than just valuable to be balanced and centered on the body. I've learned that when I'm aware of the body, when I'm aware of what's happening in my body, two things happen. One is the body is a very, very important indicator of how I'm actually feeling in any given time. The body, in some sense, has much more honesty. It's much more honest responder to the world than my mind is. The mind is really tricky. If any of you do meditation for any length of time, you realize how tricky the mind can be. The mind isn't always so honest, even though we think of ourselves as maybe honest. But the body is much more honest, so much so that I think that... I was going to say, it's kind of a non sequitur, but I like to reword the famous psychoanalytic cliche to say, to be, the body is the royal road to the unconscious. Because I found over and over again that that one of the most reliable ways to understand deeply what's going on with me and my reactions, my responses to the world, and my desires and intentions, is what's going on in my body. And I do that, you know, sitting here giving in front of you, giving these talks. I'm constantly checking into my body and feeling what's going on in my body, because I've learned that my body sometimes is the first indicator of, to me of my relationship to the audience. So, for example, if I start getting nervous and think, well, maybe people aren't understanding me, and I find I start leaning forward slightly, and I start kind of trying to make my point more firmly, as if I made it firmly, you'd understand me. So noticing what's going on in my body, then, oh, I'm leaning forward. Oh, then what else is going on here? Oh, maybe I'm a little bit worried. These people aren't understanding me, or whatever. And so then I'll kind of settle back on myself again. And settled back again, I can be here in a more balanced way, not be being pushed to respond by my reactions. My body, you know, my stomach gets tight. That tells me that I'm a little bit worried in the situation. I check into my body all the time to find out what's going on, because when I'm living my life kind of busily, like most people are, I'm not always so aware of the subtleties of my emotional and psychological reactions to things, but the body gives me a very good indication of what's going on, and often gives me an indication of how to correct for things, how to create more balance, and how to be more, a little bit more relaxed again. So the body is a great antenna for what's going on for us inside of ourselves and in our reactions to the world around us. That's one thing that mindfulness of the body is very useful for. The other thing is mindfulness of the body works kind of like, I don't know if this is the best analogy, but it's kind of like if you it's possible, you know, you're cutting carrots in the kitchen, and you kind of cut your finger a little bit, and it bleeds a little bit. And so we can do it. We kind of, you know, someone asks you who cut your finger. You say, well, I cut the finger. I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't mindful, and I cut it. And then you ask, well, who is it that's going to heal the finger? Is it the same person who cut it who's going to heal it? Well, in a sense, yes. I mean, it's not like a different person is going to do it, but the conscious volitional parts of us that can make mistakes and choose to do things, doesn't heal the cut. You can't, you know, you can't say, well, okay, I'm going to heal that cut. Okay, now is the time to do it. And start directing those cells and that blood and the immune system, and you know, it's a phenomenally complex event, right? To heal a little cut. And I don't even know if medical science knows all the different elements that go into what it takes to heal a little cut. It's a phenomenally complicated event. And our conscious mind doesn't have a clue how to do it for most of us, right? Maybe some of you do? But what we can do, so we can't direct the healing. But what we can do is create the conditions to let the natural healing happen without any interruption, without any problems. So, for example, we clean the cut. We put a Band-Aid over it. And putting a Band-Aid over it kind of protects it so that it can kind of unfold in the way that heal the way it wants to do. Awareness of ourselves, awareness of our body, is kind of like a Band-Aid or kind of like washing the wound. A lot of us hold a lot of unresolved physical phenomena in our body. Our muscles hold a lot of the psychological tensions of our life, psychological stresses of our life, sometimes the traumas of our life. And if we continue living in a cognitive world of worries and fears, running around being really busy, we just continually kind of winding tighter and tighter these muscles. But if we can stop running around chasing our worries and fears and all these things, and instead begin feeling... Actually, does the opposite. Feeling our muscles and feeling our body as it is begins to allow for those muscles to unwind, to relax. we can't necessarily cause a deep, we can do kind of simple relaxation, but a deep, deep kind of relaxation that's possible through deep meditation or deep spirituality is not something we can direct. But we have to allow for it. We have to do the work of cleaning the wound and putting the Band-Aid on it. And the form that takes for inner life is simply to hold the experience in our awareness. So we hold our physical body in our awareness. And many of you will find what a miracle it is to watch the transformation of the body when you simply hold it in awareness. Now this is all very abstract, you know, but this means even when you feel something uncomfortable or feel something really wonderful in the body, can you just hold it in awareness rather than running away from it immediately or fixing it by taking a warm shower or a bath or taking an aspirin or doing all these things we do to kind of fix it externally. Real deep spiritual change happens when we fix things internally, from the inside out, or allow things to unravel or unfold on their own. And it takes sometimes tremendous courage and strength to bring awareness into our body and feel what's going on in our body and not manipulate it, not push it away or do anything with it, but simply be with our body as it is. And see what happens as we just kind of be present for both the pleasant and unpleasant experiences of our body. We're a culture which gets phenomenal amounts of messages that we need to always do something about unpleasant physical experiences. In fact, some people even have the interpretation that if there's any physical discomfort in the body, it's a sign that something, I've done something wrong, I'm bad. I'm a failure. I don't look like the model in the commercial. In the world of mindfulness meditation, it's just tremendous, again, allowing awareness that simply brings the awareness to the experience with some curiosity to feel it and allow it to be there, not to push it away or demand it to be different or judge it, but simply let it float there in awareness, those 10 shoulders, that headache, or whatever else it might be. Does it make some sense to you? But so we start with the breath. We start with mindfulness of breathing, partly because it's something we're all of us are doing all the time, so it's an easy place to kind of develop the awareness. It has a nice rhythm to it. And so it becomes a nice anchor for the meditation. We start there. We rest there the best we can. We give some loving devotion to feeling and sensing our breath. But when something else arises in our physical experience which is more compelling than the breath or is more pronounced, more predominant in our experience than the experience of breathing, then the instructions is to let go of the mindfulness of breathing and do mindfulness of this strong sensation. So, for example, if you're sitting here and your knee begins hurting, if the knee hurts and just really mild and you hardly notice it, just stay with the breathing. But at some point, if the knee pain becomes really strong and really compelling, and it's hard to stay with the breath because the ache in the knee is stronger, let go of the breath completely. And then bring your attention fully to the knee, to simply feel and experience what's happening in the knee as it is, without trying to manipulate it or change it, noticing if there's any commentary about it, noticing if you form a relationship to it. Is there aversion to it? Because aversion and the pain are not the same thing. But most of us, if we don't see that clearly, have the two entangled with each other, and they become one and the same experience. But to see that aversion and the pain are two different things provides a tremendous possibility for the mind to be restful, or the body to be restful with uncomfortable situations. So we bring our attention into the knee, and we just feel what's going on there, as if we're going to feel and get to know knee pain like we've never known it in our life before. Like you've never really... it's like this person in your family who's been there for, you know, generations, but you never took the time to get to know them. And so you finally, after 50 years, you're interested, who is this person after all that I married? So the same thing with our knee. What is this knee? What is this experience of discomfort? We bring our attention carefully into the knee and sense it and feel it what's going on there. And it's often, what's fascinating is the experience of pain in the knee is very different than what we think it is. And many of us live in the world of thinking, where we think about things rather than experiencing it directly. And often something like physical pain is a lot harder to stay present for if we're seeing it through the filter of what we think is there, as opposed to if we simply sense and feel directly what is actually there. So you might try it next time you have some discomfort in your body. At some point, the strong sensation is no longer compelling. Maybe it goes away entirely. And then the instructions simply come back to the breathing until some other strong physical sensation calls for your attention. And it doesn't have to be an unpleasant sensation. It can be, sometimes in meditation, there can be very strong, intense, pleasant sensations that arise. Since physical sensations of great bliss arise sometimes when we're really present for ourselves in a direct way. And then the person might say, well, wow, you know, rather than kind of just feeling the physical sensation of the bliss, they go immediately into the commentary, wow, I must be the best meditator on my block. You know, if only, you know, my neighbor knew, or whatever. And so we get into, thoughts about, you know, how we're going to tell a neighbor and about my bliss. And pretty soon you've lost your bliss because you're thinking about your neighbor. But the idea is, again, to simply to feel it. But then when it's a very pleasant sensation, rather than having aversion, there might be strong identification or desire associated with it, grasping onto it. Aha, I've been meditating for 15 years, and finally I'm going to have some bliss. Well, I'm going to latch onto it like it's no tomorrow. The idea in meditation is not to be caught up in either aversion or desire, but to see if you can find that ability of awareness to be present for it in a balanced way. Oh, just allowing it to be there as it is. Just allowing it to be there as it is. There might be aversion, there might be desire, but you don't have to be caught up in it. You can just let it kind of be in the background. And just feel the strong bubbles of pleasure in the body, if that's what's going on. If there's strong sounds, some people who meditate think that sounds, outside sounds, are distractions. But in mindfulness practice, there's no such thing as a distraction, but just something else to pay attention to. So if your neighbor's dog is barking, and it's really pronounced and really compelling, and it's, you know, becoming difficult to stay with your breath, then you let go of the breath and you do listening meditation, just listening to the sound of the dog. And you listen, as long as it's pronounced, developing your awareness of the sound, developing your awareness on sound as it's there, developing your ability to be in the present moment with the sound that's happening in the present moment. It can be an itch, it can be a smell, it can be a taste, it can be whatever. A strong physical sensation arises. And the idea is simply to feel it, to be there for it. The wonderful thing that happens is that as we begin exploring and giving ourselves a chance to feel the different aspects of our body, the different senses, they tend to start becoming more alive for us. And our sense of who we are tends to kind of fill out. I think literally, if we spend all our time in the world of thoughts, we're living in a two-dimensional world. And to start feeling ourselves three-dimensionally is to start feeling what it's like to be alive in a body, what it's like to experience the world through all our senses of our body, and how to respond to the world through our body also, our feelings in our body. So part of mindfulness meditation is to awaken this capacity of the body, to make it more and more a familiar part of ourselves. And there's a kind of strength that comes with being in the fullness of our body. And I think it'll become clear what this strength is like when we start talking about next week emotions and thoughts the following week. The more fully we can be in our body, feeling our life through the body, much easier it is to do the mindfulness of emotions and mindfulness of thoughts. To do a mindfulness of emotions and mindful thoughts disembodied from our body is actually quite hard. It can be done, but it's not it's quite difficult. Any questions about any of this so far? Yes.
Not really a question, but I had a crown put on this morning, and I'm totally dentist phobic because I had a statistic pediatric dentist. And last night I was just totally fretting about it and talking to my husband. He's like, God, I'll be in there, you know. And it was almost as bad as being there, thinking about it. And then, God, the drill. You know, it's like, I was totally there.
But not here.
What was interesting, though, because I was trying to sort of pay attention to how much more I was making it worse, you know, the fear that he was going to hurt me. And then I just noticed all of a sudden, you know, I'd like relaxed. I couldn't believe how tense I had become. But it was still a horrible experience. I don't know, it's really hard. I just can't imagine getting to any point where I would feel neutral.
There are people, I've never done this, but there are people who sit here with us in Palo Alto who won't use any anesthetics when they go to the dentist. And they develop their mindfulness to such a degree that they just stay there, are mindful of the strong sensations that are going on, but they don't let themselves be bothered by it. And so it's possible to use this practice. And I imagine that a person who discovers that ability, that becomes a resource, a kind of strength, so that in the future when they go to the dentist, they're kind of prepared. They're kind of, you know, they realize that they have the capacity of mind that's greater than the pain. But I never asked them. Yeah, I've never asked them actually what kind of procedure they had, but cleaning, the rinsing part. That's what they. Yes.
But isn't that kind of not listening to your body? Isn't that also dislocating yourself from your body?
No, they're listening to themselves very, very well. They know exactly what's going on. They're not numbing themselves with anesthesia. In a sense, you would say that numbing yourself with the Novocaine or whatever, that's not letting your body tell the messages anymore. Now, this can be overdone, so I'm not saying you should never use anything at all, you know, please don't come up, you know, the most dramatic example and say, what about there? I mean, in the normal, everyday course of normal life, and you're sitting in meditation, and you feel some discomfort, don't get up and run away from your meditation or think it's a problem. Start cultivating the ability to bring awareness to that. And that becomes a real strength. If you can do that in meditation, it becomes a lot easier to do that in daily life when uncomfortable situations arise, whether physical uncomfortably or something else. Part of the power of mindfulness is that we're no longer slaves of comfort and discomfort, comfortable and uncomfortable situations, which many people are. As soon as it's uncomfortable, I'm out of here. Or people shut down or something. Yeah.
Said something along the line that it's difficult to be really mindful of emotions or thoughts if you're not already mindful of the body.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lot easier to be mindful in a balanced way of our emotional life if we're in our body, if we're aware of what's happening in our body. And we'll talk about that next week. If try not to have an emotion between now and then.
That's like a preview.
It's a preview. If you want? Yeah. Sure. Yes.
While you're meditating, what if some of the annoying things like you're bitten by a small thing she's eating or do that or your nose starts to run down the seat and do you just bring your attention to that or do you go?
Well, a Buddhist would not go swat because a Buddhist, you know, a Buddhist is committed to not harming other sentient beings.
I understand that a little. Friend of the Buddhist remarked that sometimes
you
just have to
squash
it.
And you can also do nothing. Many people, including myself, have, especially places like in Thailand or in Burma where there's so many insects, have done the great mosquito meditation. And you hear the buzzing, and so you're aware, oh, so you're listening meditation for a while, you know. But then that elicits fear, and the fear is stronger than the sound at some point, so can you do fear meditation, you know, you feel, and then the fear dissipates. And by the time the fear is dissipated, you realize that the little guy has landed. And so he feels itching, you feel all the itching meditation, you know, feel walking around. And so that's interesting. And then and suddenly you can actually feel the proboscis going in. And you're doing piercing meditation. You're sitting there, you know. And then at some point it kind of goes numb. Most immediately, kind of goes numb, and you're kind of wondering what's going on now. Yeah, a little bit, yeah. That's a week later. And so then after a while, it kind of leaves and it flies away and. And then itches, later. So it's possible to do that as a meditation. It's possible to get phenomenally concentrated on that. I'm not exactly suggesting it, but there are many people who do this, who actually, when they sit down, unless they use their common sense, but unless something really dangerous is happening, they're simply not going to move, and rather take whatever happens to be the food for their meditation practice. And itches, or the nose is running. So one of the things I like to do is kind of, sometimes I get a tickle in my throat. And so I try my best when I meditate to simply feel the tickle the best I can and not to give in to it. And sometimes I have tears going down my eyes because, you're not going to die from a tickle in your throat. It's not such a terrible thing. But it can feel that way. It's really intense, right? So it's my dedication to try to stay there and develop my mindfulness in this difficult situation that's so harmless. And it's nice because it's really harmless. You know, sometimes with a knee, it might not be harmless to stay with your knee. So you need not only pay attention carefully to what's actually happening directly, but you need to pay attention. One of the things if you pay attention directly, usually some indication of when you're kind of pushing it beyond some limit where you might harm yourself, and then you should change your posture.
Get caught up in not wanting to do anything, like you're saying, like you're just supposed to, go through it. But then what happens with my breath is that I feel like I try to suppress the breath too. Because I don't want to take a deep breath, because that feels like swatting the mosquito.
Oh.
But then I feel like I'm not getting enough oxygen. And so, like, when it comes to your breath, can you, take a really deep, just breathing deeply?
Yeah, if you need to breathe deeply, sure. But one of the things that we learn when we do mindfulness is the relationship of our breathing pattern, our breath, to our emotions and our reactions to the world. And they're very, very closely connected. So one of the things you might do is when the breath is being held, rather than taking a deep breath and kind of breaking the spell in a sense, bring your awareness to what it feels like to have a held breath. And if you bring your awareness and really feel what the heldness is like in your chest or your stomach or whatever it is, at some point it'll probably release itself. And you don't have to be the one who releases it. So just in the rhythm of breathing, every time you come to the place where it's really tight or contracted, just feel what that contraction is like. Breathe into it. And with time, it'll release. In the back.
If
thing probably everybody sits and the backache and your back is, and you're doing something and you just don't want to get up and go and you just sit there and think about it for a while. But it makes sense to me to just get up and stretch.
Yes. In normal life, yes.
Yeah. But
in meditation?
In meditation when you're sitting and that's when you stay with it.
Well, see, it's very valuable. It's not like the ultimate true thing, you know. It's not like this, you know, religious thing. But it's very valuable when we sit down in meditation to choose the length of time we're going to sit, and then sit there and work within reason, stay still, and just take whatever's given, whatever you receive, whatever's given to you that particular meditation session, and learn. See if you can find that balanced zero point. Where you don't have to, where you're free, where the awareness is free, where you don't have to act in any direction at all, where there's no aversion or judgment, no resistance, but rather the ability to just be at rest in any experience that's happening. So if it's a stiff back, it might be more valuable for you to discover that ability to rest in a balanced mode in the middle of a stiff back than it is to automatically fix it, which is often the tendency we have. And as you do that, you might find some very interesting things out about the power of awareness and about the power of what's going on in that back that you wouldn't find out if you stretched it. I mean, sometimes stretching is just the right thing, and I think yoga is great. I do yoga and for my back and all kinds of things. But for example, my shoulders might be stiff, and they hurt because they're so stiff. Well, the most natural thing in the world is you kind of stretch it for a while. So, you know, I'll just take a 5-minute break from my meditation and stretch it, you know, and I'll feel much better. And for a little bit, you feel better because you've stretched it out, for sure. But the opportunity you've lost is two things. One is you've lost the opportunity to discover that balanced awareness that doesn't have to respond or change anything, even when it's uncomfortable. That you get tremendous freedom, power of freedom, if you've discovered that ability where you don't have to act automatically on what's happening to you. That's one thing. The other thing you discover is, well, wait a minute. As you really feel that those tight shoulders really carefully, and really be present for them, and you kind of the resistance to them and your fear about them and your judgment about them kind of fall away, and you're just there as for the tension itself as it is, you begin discovering that in the heart of that tension, what's holding it there, perhaps, is this phenomenal fear of death. And maybe someone you knew died and you were present for their death and it just really spooked you. And ever since that time, you know, you've really been holding yourself really tight. And no amount of stretching usually will reveal that psychological fear. But if you really bring awareness to it, if it has that kind of psychological basis, the awareness might follow in and allow that healing to happen in a way that nothing else will. Does that make some sense? Yes.
I find that I tear a lot and I yawn a lot.
What was the first one you hear?
Tear.
Tear, oh, tear.
Come down and a lot of tears. I mean, like, and I yawn in their meditation or prayer, the same thing. And I always wondered, sometimes I'm not aware of it, and then I feel wet cheeks and tears falling on my hands. And I also find that sometimes I find myself rocking before I realize what's going on. It's just a very gentle rock.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure what all that's about.
I'm not sure either, but with such a short description of it. But it's fairly common for people, for such experiences in meditation, to represent releases. Many of us have deep-seated emotions that are kind of buried in from whatever, deep feelings of sadness, of grief, which have never really had a chance to come to the surface. And tearing is one of those forms of release. Yawning can sometimes be another form of release.
It almost feels like a cleansing taking place when it happens, and I feel lighter and better afterwards.
So all kinds of unusual things can happen. It's kind of like if we're living in the surface chatter of our mind, where many of us are living, you know, the kind of surface commentator, the sportscaster, it's like there's this, it's like putting a shell over us, and we're living in this shell of surface chatter that doesn't give it any space for deeper movements within us, or depth of who we are as a human being, to kind of bubble up. And so, you know, if you're always watching television, you know, you go home, and as soon as you get home, you turn on the television, and you'd only turn it off when you, you know, go to sleep, and we wake up in the morning, you turn it on until you leave the house to go to work. So it's always on, always watching television. You'll never know who your spouse is, right? And so there's certain kind of depth of relationship, depth of knowing each other and sharing and all that, that's not going to happen. Same thing with the mind. If we're always living in the surface chatter of the mind, a certain depth of experiencing ourselves in relationship to ourselves doesn't have a chance to come to the surface, because the surface is filled with all this chatter. And meditation helps us to quiet that surface chatter. And then it's sometimes a surprise. It makes space for other things to show themselves. You're suddenly surprised about who you're living with. You know, and in meditation, that happens to a lot of times. We suddenly, you know, we're sitting there quietly in meditation. So I didn't know that's who I was, or I didn't know that was going on, or and this stuff will bubble up, and all kinds of stuff will bubble up. Some people, it can be memories, it can be feelings and emotions. It can be body sensations of all kinds. It can be laughter. Laughter is another kind of release that some people will have. Now, in mindfulness meditation, we're not trying to self-psychologize ourselves through mindfulness practice. We're not trying to kind of, okay, I have these traumas, I have these issues, psychological issues. If, you know, let me see if I can use this meditation to get in there and pay attention and discover it and deal with it. What we're trying to do in mindfulness is simply develop awareness. And in developing awareness, understand what's actually happening in the moment. And if there is psychological healing as a result of that, fine, you'll take it. But it's not like that's not the point of meditation. It's a byproduct. It's a very important point to realize, so that we don't fill our mind with all kinds of extra agendas. Having the simplest agenda possible in meditation is the best. And the simplest agenda is simply to learn to be present for what's actually happening. It's so radically simple to be present for what's actually happening, which means we're not... To have a complicated agenda is to have the agenda to get calm or de-stressed or get insight or to get anything at all from meditation besides simply being present for what's actually happening. If you can do that, that's the best way of approaching meditation. Keep it that simple. Last one, and then we'll sit again.
When you inhale and then exhale, between the pause of the exhale and the next inhale, especially when you're meditating and paying attention to it, there's this lengthening space where it's sort of happening.
That's an important question. If there's a gap between the breaths, and if we're primarily staying present for the breaths, then there's this idle period. And if the mind is idle, it's not paying attention to the breath, there's nothing there, then that gap will often be a place where we'll wander off into thoughts, because an idle mind needs something to do. So the instructions around if there's a long enough gap is pay attention to what's called the contact points, touch points, which means that you find some physical sensation of contact in the body, and during that gap, in a kind of slow, kind of in the same kind of rhythm of the breath, bring your attention to that contact and simply feel the sensation of contact. So, for example, the knees against the floor, or the hands touching, or the lips touching, and just feel the contact until the breath comes back. So you stay in touch with something physical and tangible. Okay, so let's sit again. So begin by gently closing your eyes and taking an alert, upright posture. And again, it's good to take a few deep breaths. And as you breathe in deeply, to use an in-breath to connect to your body from the inside, to awaken the sensations. And as you breathe out, to relax the body. Then let your breath be normal. And again, you might go through your body and relax any place that's obvious and maybe easy to relax a little bit. Shoulder, belly, face. And then feel your body. Feel as much of your body as you can as you sit here. Not so much that you're outside your body or above your body watching it, but let yourself feel the body's experience of itself. How does the body feel itself at this moment? Can you let go of any resistance in the body? Surrendering to the experience of being embodied. The sense of vitality, of energy that courses through the body. Feeling the places in the body that where your vitality is flowing, and feeling the places in your body where your vitality is frozen, places of tension. Feeling it without commentary, just letting it be. No need to be any different. Simply holding it in the great expanse of awareness. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of the body's experience of breathing. How the body feels, senses the inhalations, the exhalations. feeling how the inhalation begins from the depth of your body, from deep inside, and arrives as an expansion, a movement, a pressure that grows. And how the exhalation is the release of that pressure, expansion. As the movement of the breathing out, returns to that quiet, deep place inside from which the inhalation begins. If you find yourself drifting off in thought, take a moment to feel how preoccupation in thought is a kind of a disembodied experience. And then drop yourself down again into the three-dimensionality of the body itself. Drop down into the embodied experience of being alive right now. So in this next week, I hope you take your time. Give yourself the time to find out what your body is feeling, maybe more often than you tend to do. It's a great, marvelous, fun, challenging, insightful practice to discover what the body is what's flowing and expressing itself in the body. So may you all have a happy week and see you next week.